Hi, and welcome back to our community, Unsheltered. Diana Cooper from Brookings Core Response Team has been my guest for several shows now, and we've been looking at the issues of affordable housing and our housing crisis in the area, as well as touching on some of our area's other significant issues of adequate public health and mental health solutions. How are you doing today, Diana?
I'm good. It's been a great Saturday. I just kind of, well, mostly sat around, but yeah.
Good for work. You. I actually worked on a jigsaw puzzle this afternoon.
Did
I
you?
I just needed to clear my head, you know, and sometimes just doing something like that where it's totally different than anything else I do, right? It's just, using a different part of the brain.
I did half video games, half work. So, you know, it was
you.
A good variety. I used to do jigsaw puzzles, but now the kids lose all the pieces to them. So we just kind of do jigsaw. Yeah. I saw a few pieces out there today. So who knows what they're from?
Yeah, I have noticed that, especially during this whole COVID lockdown, you know, I've started doing jigsaw puzzles again. And I've noticed that at least two of the puzzles that I've bought have been missing pieces.
Oh, so, I'm sorry about that.
Right? Yeah, it was you, right? It was your kids that did it.
Yeah, somebody's
but, you know, kid. I'm putting it together. The boxes have never been opened.
Oh, that's weird.
Right?
You must have dropped a piece somewhere.
Oh, no. Well, probably, actually.
You'll find it later.
I'd rather blame the manufacturer, though.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, just weather-wise, it's blowing like crazy here.
Yeah. So, interestingly, I know there's been a lot of stories about, you know, the wind. Specifically, Jake was mentioning a story about when the ladder fell. So, I have a story, but mine's not as funny.
In fact, no chim-chim true stuff on them. Yeah,
it's okay. Not. Several weeks ago, and I'm sure many people saw this online, one of our chickens died because the wind blew and there was a pallet that Matt leaned up against the coop and it blew so hard that it knocked that pallet over. And so now we did get...
And sacrificed the chicken?
Yeah.
Oh, God.
We felt really bad.
Yes, of course.
So there's nothing loose in the run anymore.
Excellent.
And pretty much even around the side of the house where they graze. So we make sure now... I mean, it's been really gusty out there. So we make sure now everything's put away and tied down.
I know. I was in my greenhouse a few hours ago and I'm thinking, the roof's going to come off the greenhouse. This is ridiculous. I mean, it's... Yeah. It's
We've had some pretty... my grandma lived up in Gold Beach, right along near where the airport is, and it's just straight, you know, open field to her house, and so the wind was crazy there. Yeah.
Yeah, and cold. You know, I swear it's coming right off the Arctic, you know? It's just not my favorite.
Yeah.
So... Diana, I know that you have experienced a personal loss this past week when your mentor and friend Mary Curtis passed away. And I really, my deepest condolences, because that hurts. That hurts.
It's difficult to, she was older. Mm-hmm. She was in her 80s. You know, she'd been on a hospice for several weeks, so we knew it was coming, but it's just hard in general to lose someone who's such a good support system, and I've already lost, you know, two very close people in my support system over the last year, so this one, especially right now with all the work I'm doing, for some reason hit me. I mean, they just all hit you hard, I suppose.
Of course.
So I've had a lot of moments where I've had to just sort of step away for a minute.
Mm-hmm. I would love to hear about Mary, because you told me a little bit about her, but she sounds like she was just an amazing person. Can you talk a little bit about her mentoring you and what that meant and what she meant to the community? And if you have to cry, you can do that, and we'll just cut away and come back. Yeah.
I do find most of the time when I'm talking about it, it's when I'm, you know, it's late at night when I'm sitting there thinking about, because actually we talked a lot late. I mean, she was a night owl. She'd send me an email at 11:30 and I'd still be awake and respond.
That's great.
So it's, you know, late at night when I'm sitting there thinking I want to send her an email or something.
Yeah.
She sent me the last email maybe a couple months ago, because through this whole process of starting Brookings Correspondence, you know, even back in 2017 when I was sort of fiddling with the idea of it, Mary Curtis was the one that supported me and that I turned to with all those important questions. So she, you know, probably not known over here in Curry County, but in Jackson County and in Josephine County and maybe some other areas, you know, she was pretty well known. She was a CASA for many, many years and just really loved children, you know, and especially had a heart for children who had been through trauma or had been through the DHS system, you know, child welfare, whether they were removed or not removed. She just really wanted to help keep families together. I think that was her lifelong mission, was to help keep families together when possible and to help heal children regardless. And so she, you know, some years ago actually founded an organization in Medford called the Family Nurturing Center. And I've heard all kinds of stories kind of how it came about. And she used to drive people, you know, go pick up kids in her, I don't know if it was a station wagon, but, you know, old car, and she'd go pick up the kids because they didn't have a bus yet. So it was kind of like, sort of like Head Start, but very intentionally focused on, you know, trauma and being trauma-informed and trauma-informed teaching. You know, low ratios of kids. I think it was, some classrooms were 4 kids to 1 adult. And
wow, that's
some
nice.
Might have been, yeah, especially, well, really just any kids. I feel so grateful. I've always said this. I'm certainly, you know, wish that I could undo the harm that I had done on myself, on Matt, on our kids. But at the same time, I'm so grateful for having the opportunity to meet people like Mary Curtis. I say that about NA all the time, you know. It must be really sad to not have a program of some sort or to not have some kind of just continual self-care. And NA and Al-Anon AA, those are really just an ongoing working on yourself. And so
amazing support. I mean, really.
Yeah.
Amazing,
I mean, just support. Lifelong, you can continue discovering things about yourself. Yep. So, but anyway, so Mary Curtis, the Family Nurturing Center was, you know, when we went to treatment, we went to, crisis housing on King Street. So there was 3 different crisis housings. We maintained King Street was the best. And so when we go to treatment, you know, we'd walk every morning. It was the stroller brigade. So everybody'd get their strollers out. There was no bus to treatment. You walked. And staff member walked with you. And so we would start at King Street, you know, there was probably between 8 and 10 families usually at King Street. And same with the other places. And then we'd walk, pick up all the other parents and kids, walk to the other one, pick up all those. So just be this, you know, like 60, 70 strollers going through downtown Medford.
Oh, I love
and
that.
So that was Monday through Friday. And we'd get there at 8 and we'd leave at noon. And so during that time, we got connected with the Family Nurturing Center because Eric, who was 3.5 at the time, and Tad, who was about 2, started having, you know, when kids go through trauma, well, when people go through trauma, it's just more obvious, I think, in kids because they're so unrestricted, you know.
Right.
But when people go through trauma, when they're healing from that or when they get in a safe environment, it's safe enough for them to act out. So it looks like a step backwards.
Yes, but it's not.
And it's not. It's not. And you just got to hang in there with them and teach them the right way.
Yeah.
And it's all about, it's not about what not to do, it's all about what to do. And so you really got to tell people what they should do or how they can do it. Right. So that's the same with kids. And so our kids, you know, Eric and Tad, Noah was a baby. Ada was probably 5, 5.5. In fact, I think she was almost 6. And she did not have the same reaction to trauma that Eric and Tad had. So they started kind of acting out, and it was actually Tad who at one point chased me. And I mean, he had that, he was kind of going through something where he was hitting Matt.
Yeah.
And, he had never done that to me though. And then one day he like chased me to hit me or bite me or something. And I was like, oh, this is not going to work. So we reached out for help, and they connected us with Family Nurturing Center, and they, brought Eric and Tad into the classrooms. They had the classrooms there. And these really great, amazing classrooms with, you know, like kind of natural surrounding, like a natural playground area and just all kinds of, like a water station and a sand station. It was really great. So they were there for preschool, and Eric even transitioned into kindergarten with their help. And we went through PCIT, which is parent-child interaction therapy, and it sounds like...
wonderful, actually.
Yeah, it does. It's really great. We learned the pride skills, which is sort of how to interact with not just kids, but I use this on adults and kids. I mean, it's really great for just interacting. But so the pride skills, and I'm probably going to botch it because it's been a long time since I remembered all of them. Yeah, see, I don't even remember the P. Reflect is the R. Is imitate. D is describe. And E is enthusiasm. And I don't know what the P is. But it's basically just like letting them lead. And, you know, sometimes we do this in the workplace where we want to, we sort of want to integrate in. And, you know, there's actually studies where people who dress like their bosses and kind of maybe not walk, talk, and act exactly like their bosses, but sort of mingle in that way, get raises more often or are more socially acceptable. I don't know if that's right or wrong, but
it's because we like to see ourselves reflected back.
I mean,
that's just the way it is.
And that is exactly what the pride skills are for kids. And it sounds so simple, and it kind of, you know, it's really coming from where we were at. It was almost kind of hard to believe that that was even something that would work. It was too simple. but it was amazing. And I mean, the kids just, it absolutely worked. It just, they immediately blossomed under, you know, that. And we don't do it as much in the same way because they're not little kids anymore. But it was really great for us to learn. And Matt and I both did it separately with each kid. So it was, it was a lot of commitment. I think we each did it for a year with each kid. And then, so along
this
journey...
And this was Mary Curtis that was that brought you into this,
She wasn't the therapist there, but she was the director and the founder. And I didn't meet her until months in. What happened was my tire on my car, we had just gotten a car and... I'm not even sure if we had insurance on it yet at the time. We were still in treatment housing, and we got the car, and one of the tires blew out, or two of the tires blew out, I can't remember. And so I had to get new tires. And I remember working with our the teacher that was our contact. She did our home visiting, and she helped set up to where we could come in and get the money to replace the tires. And so when I called, it was this little sweet voice on the other end of the line, and she was from North Carolina. I didn't know that, but she definitely had a kind of a Southern accent, and I had never heard her. Usually it was Colette that was at the front desk, the only person that ever answered the phone. So I thought this was this new office lady or someone, and she was just so sweet. So I went in to get the money, and she gave it to me, and then she introduced herself. And we got to talking, and she asked me at some point, I don't remember if it was that time or if it was the next time I saw her, she asked me if I would come speak. She had this little sort of event she was doing to raise money and kind of wanted to hear from some of the parents. And so I said, sure, I'll come speak. And so she said little, and I got there, and there it was like black tie event and...
Oh, my word.
I mean, it was
word.
Real fancy. when I'm really glad that I wore, like, the nicest thing I owned. And there was about 200 people there, so it was a little bit bigger than I thought.
Wow, that's not little. Little in what universe?
Yeah. And she was kind of like that. She'd say, oh, just this little thing I'm doing. And, And so, and then
but
I found out.
That's really perfect,
you know,
though, right? Because you wouldn't have done it otherwise.
Yeah. Oh, no, yeah. I wouldn't have. I probably
No, exactly.
Because I actually was pretty confident in public speaking, but I had never spoken to that many people at one time. And so, yeah, and then I found out when I got there also that I was the main speaker. And so, you know, I know she didn't like spring it on me necessarily, but it turned out really great. I shared my story and I really had sort of a very descriptive way of telling it. And, you know, there was some people that I think were really moved by that. But it was a really great experience for me. And it kind of gave me sort of a taste of the nonprofit world because after that, she sort of brought me in and I did several speaking events with her or for her. And then I also, she took me to Salem a couple of times to speak at the Capitol. I think one hearing was on early childhood education.
Wow.
And so they did end up passing the bill to fund relief nurseries and early childhood or early learning preschools and whatnot. So that was really cool. I can't remember what the other one we went for. But
interesting the way that she just kind of brought you along, right?
And
introduced you to all kinds of situations where you actually could grow.
Yeah. And I realize a lot of that was how I present. And, you know, I'm able to tell my story, but present it in a way that makes sense and is constructive, but is also very real. And and I think that appealed to a lot of people. So I'm you know, on one hand, I'm very grateful for the opportunity and what it gave to me. And on the other, I realized that there were some people who maybe didn't get to share their story necessarily. And so, but she was always pretty fair when it came to things like that. She was just, you know, she always strived for equity. So, but me personally, you know, I went with her to several speaking events. Eventually she took me to a few, there was a first conference I had ever been to. I didn't know what a conference was. I've been to many now, but, my first conference was in Woodburn, Oregon, and we went up there. We went to Woodburn, and I think we stayed in Silverton. And when we went to Woodburn, we did this tour of Woodburn with the guide there, and he was telling us, you know, all about the history of Woodburn and, you know, the Hispanic population there and basically how they weren't represented. It was really impactful for me because it was talking about how that was the first time I had heard how leadership should reflect its population in order to equally represent it. And so the first thing we did was walked through City Hall and saw the pictures of all the councilors and mayors and, you know, over the last however many years, and they were all white men.
Oh, wait, that's a shock.
Yeah, and he said, do you see anything interesting here? Mm. And I think it was something around a population of 70 to, I could be off a little bit, not much, but it was something around 70% Latin community and representation in leadership. And that was really my first experience. And I was there with Mary Curtis. We were walking along. Our guide, it was so great. Our guide did the entire tour, walked all around the town backwards so that he could talk to us.
That's
he
must wonderful.
Have done that a million times.
Exactly. To know where to put his feet.
Yeah. Yeah. It was really great. And we learned a lot about, that's the first time I had ever heard NIMBY. We talked about NIMBYism and how Woodburn struggled to.
So say what NIMBY is.
Oh, NIMBY, not in my backyard.
Thank you.
And he showed us an apartment complex specifically built for the Latinx community because they were so their housing was so subpar, and they were such a big representation of the community. So we talked about how that came about, how that complex came about, and how it was, there was so much pushback on it.
Because people
didn't,
backyard.
Right, they didn't want it there. Where, we don't know. Just not there. Wherever
exactly.
there is.
Yes, exactly.
So that trip really...
Kind of like the whole homeless thing, right?
Yeah, like...
Not in my backyard.
I know, yeah, it's very... Right? It's frustrating because you see this... You see the end result of both, of when those projects get derailed, and then you and people struggle even further, but you also see the end result of when those projects do happen, mm-hmm. and how impactful it is for the community. And even though it's, you know, 30 units, 60 units, whatever, that's so many families and so many, you know, in order to break the cycle of poverty and addiction and all of that, you have to start somewhere. And so starting at 30 units, starting at 60 units, whatever the case may be, 10 units, I mean, it's not too little. There's nothing that's too little.
I mean, you have to start somewhere, right?
We have to, yeah.
And the fact that everything is so connected. And mm-hmm. I think that's the thing that, you know, people keep wanting to not see the connections.
Right.
You know, and it is connected, mm-hmm. you know, the amount of money you have coming in and whether or not you have a roof over your head and what your physical health is and what your mental health is. I mean, they're all intricately connected.
Yeah, and there's income and then there's wealth, and those are two different things. And I know we're sort of sliding into other topics, but
let's,
you know,
slide away. I'm sure Mary will be very happy with that.
Oh, I'm yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, there's income, which is essentially how much you make in a year, and then there's wealth, which is sort of not just the money that you hold or the income you hold, but it could be that your parents hold, or your mm-hmm. grandparents hold, or mm-hmm. someone close to you. So wealth impacts how resilient we are when it comes to financial burdens, because while our income is, I mean, I guess you could say sometimes flexible, but not really. For most of us, our income is not flexible. We, you know, we can't, we could maybe get a draw here or there, but it's right. not like we can increase our income. But your wealth and being able to lean on
yep.
and draw from the income of others is sort of the whole idea of wealth. And that's where we see a lot of, differences, like I said, in how resilient a person is and how they're able to respond to economic growth or, you know, rising prices of housing. You know, that income inequality, which is actually, that conversation's going on a lot right now, more so than ever before. We're talking about $15 minimum wage.
Yeah, and that's probably because it's, you know, just because COVID hit and
sure,
so many
yeah.
people were out of work. And right?
COVID is a catalyst for...
It is. It's an amazing catalyst.
These in-depth, larger conversations, but also... scaled down into conversations we're having in the community with our peers. And mm-hmm. so it's really, I think we talked about this last time. There's no way to compare the good to the bad that's come out of it. But just to look at these conversations that are coming out, it makes a lot of us very hopeful.
Yes.
It really does. And seeing people change their minds. And because I think... Well, I come from one side of it, but, you know, I think there are some people that hear me talk or hear some of us talk and think, well, if they would just see it from my side. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, we have. That's where I came from. It took me a long time to unlearn some of those thoughts and some of those sort of stereotypes that I held, even when I was the one going through it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's great to be hearing these conversations and to see people changing their minds and learning and growing. And I don't know if we would have done that the same way without COVID.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I remember when we were probably 2 or 3 months into COVID, and I was kind of looking at the debacle that we had, you know. I mean, everything was being shut down, and businesses, and the economy was going belly up. And I remember thinking, well, yeah, this is a catastrophe, and it's an opportunity. We have the opportunity to, instead of going back to the way it was, we have the opportunity to envision a future that is better than our past. And make it better. You know, make it better for all of us. Not just, you know, some, but all of us. Yeah.
Yeah, there is kind of going back to the sort of the wage gap and the income inequality, there is this sort of connection to, you know, when there's economic growth, whether it's, you know, maybe we have retirees moving in with their money and they want, you know, they're investing in the community in various different ways, mm-hmm. or if not so much for our area, but in other areas when there's a lot of building happening or something. Well, anytime there's a lot of economic growth, when there isn't building happening, we see housing prices go up because the demand goes up. Mm-hmm. And when there's not income inequality, we see the kind of the burden falling the same way on low, medium, and high income earners. But when we have such a income inequality, it means that those at the higher end of the income scale are able to cushion that a little better. Yes, their costs do go up, but they have the, whether it's the background wealth from generationally or mm-hmm. whether it's their own increase in income, mm-hmm. they're able to sort of shoulder that a little bit better. And those at the bottom end of the scale are just not able to at all. They're not able to shift any resources to cover that. So they just end up, you know, whether they're moving in with friends and family and they're doubled up, or they're, you know, homeless, they're sort of priced out. Because when there's a shortage, especially when it comes to buying, when there's a shortage, it's easier for people who are at the higher end to, you know, they can purchase. And so sometimes what that looks like, and I'm certainly not saying that's all that's happening here, but we've seen this. Sometimes when that happens, we have people from out of the area who do have the wealth who come in and are able to buy, or, you know, whatever the case may be. And those who've been around here longer, who are stuck in kind of whatever wage gap they're in, are priced out and essentially have to leave the area.
They're pushed out of their own community.
Yeah, and this happens in communities all over, mm-hmm. But you know, we do have that element here for sure. And so with the lack of affordable housing here, it's really kind of shown a lot of the gaps.
Yeah. I mean, when you look at the fact that we don't have worker housing, so, I mean, we're talking about the waiters and waitresses and, you know, I mean, the people who are in the service business, which is what the tourist community depends on when they come to town, they don't make enough money to be able to actually live in the town in which they work.
And that's crazy. Caregivers.
Yes,
I mean, that's something we really need to think about, because there are so many, I mean, I know many caregivers right now who are either living in their car, or there are a few that are living upriver that are caregivers in our community.
Oh my God.
I knew one who was living in a motel. I'm sure there are, you know, that happens a lot. And then there are some who are, you know, move in to the place where they're caregiving. Mm-hmm. And I know a certain person in particular who moved in, and unfortunately we also have a shortage of caregivers right now. Mm-hmm. And so she ended up by default being a 24/7 caregiver, but not getting paid for that 24/7. And so we really need to think about this generation, especially a generation of seniors who are in need of care already, and those who are going to be in the next 10 years, and how we're going to support caregivers in housing. I mean, in staying housed, in
because
being
that's actually
secure.
Critical. I mean, you know, I look out
Absolutely.
At this community, and you're right. I mean, the number of us folks with gray hair is enormous, and yeah. frankly, it's you know, for me, it's very nice, you know, yeah. that when I go into Freddy's or
yeah.
wherever, I see people that look like me. You know, I'm not yeah. an anomaly. You know,
I think our age here, and this is kind of with the last sort of census data, statewide, I believe it's like 35-36% of the population is 55 and over, but in Curry County, it's 55%.
Yeah.
It's definitely, yes, much
yes,
higher.
Yes, yes. And I see with my own eyes that, you know, every year the little things get harder to do. You know, mm-hmm. it's harder to pick up something that weighs 30 pounds, or it's harder to move something, or it's harder to dig a garden. Lots of things become harder.
Mm-hmm.
And you do get to the point where just kind of doing the normal daily things, you need help, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I know. As Matt, you know, is a caregiver, and he works part-time right now, and can't pick up any extra hours, but there have been several offers of paid caregiving, both at part-time and full-time, and any shift available. So that, and we also work with, I mean, many of the people out on the street, or many of the people in subpar housing that are low income, it's pretty equivalent to our county average, age average. Are, you know, the people who are living without housing or living in subpar housing are mostly elder. And so us trying to get caregivers for them, which that's a whole other thing, trying to get caregivers for people without housing. Mm-hmm. But in general, you know, looking for caregivers has been something that we've struggled to find. And I mean, we're talking calling 20, 30 people on a list and getting no.
Wow.
So, yeah. And there's various reasons for that. But we also see a trend of caregivers who are struggling to afford housing. And some may be on unemployment right now because, I mean, that's sort of a job that during COVID, that was a really risky job.
Yes.
And it still kind of is.
Yes.
Both on the caregiver and on, you know, the person who's receiving care.
Exactly.
And while it is, you know, crucial to have a caregiver if you're in that position, I know that several people did lose their jobs because it was just too risky, especially those yep. who had private pay. There was a couple who it just felt too risky.
Yep. Yep.
So, yeah, that's one that we should be focused on a lot for our community is caregivers. I know teachers as well, but I mean, we definitely have a lot of areas we could
go
over
goodness,
when it
yeah.
comes to gaps yeah. in housing, but specifically for our area, that's an important one.
And recently, you know, just in the last few weeks, we've seen that Curry County's public health and their mental health has been turned over to the state, basically to Oregon Health Authority for oversight. And I think that the state is also focusing on Curry County's lack of affordable housing.
Mm-hmm.
I know that we briefly touched on this last week, but how are those things all linked up? How?
Well, you know. One direct link is the CCOs. Oregon Health Authority, you know, oversees the CCOs, which are the coordinated care organizations that distribute our Medicaid dollars, like Oregon Health Plan. So the CCOs specifically are, it's not really being asked. They are required to put a certain amount of money, and I don't know the numbers offhand, but they're required to put a certain amount of money into housing right now in Curry County, but I'm sure in other areas as well. Mm-hmm. And so there are currently pots of money out there for housing. One of our, I think, struggles locally is that we don't really have much land to expand on. Well, Brookings doesn't necessarily. Curry County does. And there are some areas up north. You know, I know Beth has been talking about the Ophir School, and that's certainly one that I think the funding could be used on. Mm-hmm. You know, it's in the county and it's sort of out of the way, but with the right supports, I think that that's one that could be successful. Mm-hmm. But we do need workforce housing and just affordable housing in general in the cities too. I mean, we do. And the CCOs are, I don't know how, you know, they're required to put the funding in, but I don't know how much of that is going to be for Curry right. County.
Right.
So that's sort of how directly we're going to be affected mm-hmm. as far as the state is concerned. Mm-hmm. And then more money will come down the pike too with some of the bills that are going through. So
what are some of those bills?
Well, if federally, if the Housing is Infrastructure Act does pass, you know, I can't remember exactly how much. That was somewhere in the vicinity of $75 billion, I believe, to mm-hmm. head out to the states for housing, mm-hmm. Which locally will have a big impact. I mean, it's $75 billion doesn't seem like a lot for the whole country, but when you break that down and there's actually a bigger return on it than just the money that goes into the housing. And so I think that that's one way. Mm-hmm. I don't know as much about, I know HUD has some funding that's coming through as well, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Especially to redo a lot of the housing that's subpar and
well, that
struggling.
Seems to be a real area, doesn't it? That you know, if I look around the neighborhoods here, I can see that there are houses that are empty mm-hmm. and have been empty for quite some time. I can also see houses that are sort of dilapidated and yeah. really need to be refurbished. There have to be opportunities for, yeah. you know, reconstructing or refurbishing or, you know, maybe adding on to structures,
yeah.
right? I mean, we
yeah,
have to kind of think out of the box. If we're running out of land, then we have to think out
yeah.
of the box, right?
Yeah, I think that refurbishing many of the units, you know, several people have talked about that kind of online, you know, mm-hmm. why don't we come together as a community and sort of redo all of these dilapidated empty houses and use those for low-income housing.
Yeah.
Which would be a great project. And, yep. you know, I'm wondering maybe if that bill passes, how much of that funding would go towards just that.
And I saw a Facebook post just the other day that was LaRose Felicity was talking about, it's called the Green Affordable Housing Project.
Yeah.
And it's local. It's, you know, kind of right here in Brookings or certainly, you know, the southern part of Curry County. And that's what they're talking about. They're talking about renovating or remodeling or rehabilitating units or parts of houses or whatever to make new
yeah.
affordable housing available to people who need it.
And I wonder, I think that her and I've talked just briefly, I mean, real mm-hmm. briefly about this. Mm-hmm. And I think that she's aiming for sort of that sustainability, you know, it being a green project. I don't know what all they're going to put, but I imagine that they're going to try to do it in a way that is somewhat sustainable, whether mm-hmm. they're going to have solar panel or, you know, I don't know as much about that as they do for sure. So,
right. Well, she's yeah. looking for people who know how to do remodeling and stuff like that. I think they're having a meeting on May
27th. I bet we have
May
a lot 27th. Of people
right?
tucked away in this
right?
community.
Right.
That
And she's amazing. I mean, yeah. I've seen pictures of what she has done personally, remodeling,
yeah.
and she's amazing. Huh. She not only has amazing skills, but she's like got a design kind of flair that's like, wow. So, yeah, I mean, I'm thinking that that would work. A lot of us have room that, you know, we could add a house, or not add a house, but add a couple of rooms or something. And
so that- I wonder, and I kind of wanted to give a little bit of, especially since we're talking about housing, you know, I kind of want to give a little bit of a plug for the Curry County Housing Committee that is the new housing committee that they have. And I actually have not personally attended one, and I will. I was just talking about that with Beth the other day.
You can't be everywhere. You can't be everywhere.
It's hard. We actually, not that we have it updated as well as we should, but our whole team, you know, the core team has sort of a spreadsheet of all the meetings that we attend separately, because there's so many, and they're all really great, and there's a lot of collaboration that happens. They're kind of all for different things. But we sort of have this, you know, this person goes to this and this and this meeting, and this person goes to this, and then we sort of all check in so we can spread out. we try not to double dip in any meetings, because, you know, there's a lot. But so there, we haven't attended the housing committee meeting. I was just talking to Beth about this the other day, about how, you know, I'd love to kind of put more of a plug in for it, or just sort of even spread what's needed in there, what voices maybe are underrepresented. Beth had kind of mentioned that maybe having more of a voice for people who actually are without housing. There's several in there already. But yeah, so I do intend on attending them. And I actually think that it would be really good to get more community member involvement, just even if it's just to listen in, because there's not only a lot you can get out of the meetings, but there's also sometimes, you know, in various meetings, I'll kind of hear the whole meeting and I'll go, you know what, I didn't hear this talked about. Maybe this is something that I can bring up.
Mm-hmm.
And it, so, you know, if we don't, we think someone's there representing us and speaking and about what we would also talk about, but there's really not. And, you know, just kind of the same at city council. I think that they're, you know, people probably, well, maybe not. I don't know what people assume. Maybe I shouldn't put conjecture. But I think I used to assume, well, a lot of people go to city council meetings and they speak, and if something really sideways was happening, we'd hear about it. But that's not true. And I want to put this disclaimer
there are
in.
Not a lot of people at city council meetings. There really aren't. No.
But I do want to put the disclaimer that I only started going to city council meetings last June. Mm-hmm. So I've only been going for about a year, although I've attended almost every one, and I will continue to do so. I have no idea what the attendance on those meetings looked like before COVID. So in my brain, it could be like, well, nobody's going because of COVID. I don't know. But they're not well attended.
I would go when there were problems. That's when I would show up, when there was a problem that.
Oh gosh! See, we need to get in there and be more proactive. That's what it is.
I know.
It's hard though. There's not enough time in the day, and we need more people, more ears, more voices. Even if it's just more ears, even if you don't go to talk. There's something about having more people in there.
Yeah.
That if something was like, I don't know if that's what the direction we should go as a community.
Well, and the reality is that the way city government is set up here is, you know, we've got these various commissions or committees that kind of make the decisions, the beginning decisions, and then pass it on to city council, who then either adopts it or rejects it or whatever. But the problem is that there are so many committees and commissions, number one, right? So it's really hard to keep your thumb on all of them. And you don't necessarily know what's coming up for discussion on them. So
you'd kind of have to be there sort of from the beginning. And I don't know when the beginning is, because some of these conversations have been going on for years probably.
Yep.
And so, you know, it'll get brought back up in a meeting. So we've sort of, well, me, but also, you know, Michelle comes with me to a lot of the meetings. So I've sort of decided, well, hell, I just need to be at all the, you know, planning, budget, special
meetings,
all of
them. That's a lot of meetings.
It is a lot of meetings.
Yeah.
But because I'm still sort of learning some of those, mm-hmm. and what the function of all of them are, there have been things over the last year that have come up out of the blue, not for everybody else, but for me, it was out of the blue because mm-hmm. I didn't attend a planning committee meeting or mm-hmm. I didn't attend the budget committee meeting.
Right.
So it came up for a vote and I'm like, wait, hold on. Where was this even talked
right.
about?
Right.
So you actually do to participate meaningfully. Mm-hmm. You actually need to attend all of the various meetings. Not to participate in general, and people should go even just to city council meetings. That's great.
Right.
But to have that, you know, for us as an organization with one of our, you know, with advocacy being in our mission statement, mm-hmm. in order for us to advocate in a meaningful way and an impactful way, we will have to attend them all to kind of get to be able to make sense of all of it.
And I remember Jake saying on one of his chats that once, by the time it's gotten to the city council, it's almost too late.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
Because the discussion is over at that point. The discussion with the community is over
right.
at that
yeah,
point.
Yeah, because there's not much back and forth. Sometimes there's mm-hmm. a few comments or questions, but for the most part,
yeah, it's not really back and forth.
Is,
no.
Right.
No, exactly. And yeah. and it's problematic now that we don't have Jake, right? Because yeah. Jake would at least, on his chats, would at least keep us updated on, you know, yeah. some of the stuff that was coming in front of city council so that we could, you know,
yeah.
at least express an opinion. But, you know.
Yeah, I wish sort of that, and I've actually been trying to do some of this. I haven't been as consistent as I would like, but I've been trying to publish even just the agenda page, you know, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. to my Facebook page. So it's out there and anybody who wants to see it can see it. And if
right.
And I think the first few times I did that, people thought that I was posting it because of what was on there, but I was just posting it. Sometimes mm-hmm. there was nothing of, you know, I won't say nothing of substance, but
right.
sometimes there was nothing of relevance to our mission that was on there, but I want people to see the agenda.
Yeah. Because it might mean something to somebody else, you know?
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and just to like, you know, the first couple times, maybe people are like, oh, what is that? Is that what they talk about at the city? You know, but maybe after a while, they'll want to go down and talk about something.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to continue to try to do that. The city of Brookings has a new, I don't know if they had an old page, honestly, but they have a new Facebook page. Mm. And so, yeah, it would be good if they put kind of the agenda on there
mm-hmm.
too. And
I don't think I've seen that page. I've gone to their website, but I don't think I've seen the Facebook page, no.
Oh, yeah.
I'll have to go look.
I'm following it.
Okay.
When Great. Sometimes stuff pops up from there. I don't know who manages it, but, you know, they do a pretty good job, so.
Good.
It's about time we get a Facebook mm-hmm. page as a city.
Yeah.
Sort of where a lot of people are.
Yes, yeah. And we have a woman on council now, which is
we do.
You know, another kind of amazing thing.
Yeah, I from the planning committee, mm-hmm. Michelle Morosky, and I don't really know her, and so yeah, I don't really know her. I've been to the last few meetings, and so I've seen her up there, and I think she's doing probably, you know, what most of us would do in that position, just kind of like listening and sort of feeling out. I mean, she has experience on the planning committee, so mm-hmm. she obviously has a pretty decent view of the city in and of itself and how they work, but she's kind of there, you know, sort
but of
listening,
so
taking
much
it
to
in.
Learn. There is so much to learn.
There is. I feel like it would take me, even after going to almost every meeting and mm-hmm. now going to all of the separate committees and whatnot, mm-hmm. I'm sure even Jake maybe learned a few things even in the end.
I'm sure.
So it's probably a lifelong process of learning how government works.
And it's always smart when you're in the position of being, you know, the newbie. It's always smart to listen more than you talk.
Mm-hmm.
Because you really don't know.
We would have a really quiet council because there's four that are fairly new.
And all of them like to talk, so there we go. Yeah. But, you know, it does behoove one to listen more than talk when you're new. Because there's so much that you don't know and so much that you can learn from listening to people who've been there for a while.
As opposed to opening mouth, inserting foot.
Exactly. which is kind of brings us all back to the mentor idea, right? That really mentoring is something that should and needs to be happening all the time. You know, those of us who have life experiences and have put in some time on planet Earth could and should reach out to some of the newer human beings, right? And kind of, you know, it doesn't mean that my experiences have been your experiences or will be your experiences, but there's a certain amount of wisdom gained from having life experiences that, if shared, might make a difference, you know?
And, you know, Mary Curtis never, you know, experienced homelessness and never experienced addiction. And so it was something rare to have a person who did not come from that. She came from, I won't say like wealth, although, you know, there was some generational money there. So I guess there was some wealth. And she acknowledged coming from a place of privilege and, you know, especially being in the South and that would have been, gosh, I don't know exactly how old she was, but it would have been
if she was in her 80s, then it would have been the 30s and 40s that she was growing up.
And she talked about a lot of stories, you know, about, there was a lot of racism back then and she, again, North Carolina and
she would have been sort of a Southern belle, so there would have been,
And she talked about stories about, you know, out in the fields and sort of going out into the fields and there being, you know, black workers out there. I mean, even literally picking cotton and picking vegetables and things like that. And her kind of just sort of bouncing around and doing her thing. But she's told me several stories. So she fully recognized coming from a place of privilege and somewhat wealth. But she certainly never experienced, she never experienced homelessness. She never experienced addiction. And so it was really quite rare to have someone, at that time in my life, to have someone be so open and understanding. And it wasn't even just like understanding. I mean, it wasn't like she felt like she needed to understand my life necessarily, but just to guide me and to believe in me in a way that, you know, most people did not, even people who had struggled did not. So maybe there was something there that she had because she didn't experience those things, but was so open. Mm-hmm. So you don't even have to come from that kind of a background. You don't have to come from, you know, you don't have to have the same experience as the person that you're helping or mentoring to be effective. You just have to do it. You just have to care enough. And there is a lot of value in having mentorship, whether it's, you know, spiritual, personal, professional, whatever the case may be. That's why in NA, you know, you have a sponsor. They have a sponsor. They have a sponsor. You have grand sponsors. And
yes.
Because we all need to have something to lean back against in times of stress. But we also want to have someone there to share in our successes.
Yeah,
so,
exactly. Yeah. All of that stuff is so important. If you don't have somebody to share it with, if you don't have somebody who can say, atta girl, you know, when you've accomplished something great or be able to say, you might want to take a look at it from a different perspective here. Or to just remind you that there is another perspective.
She was very good at both holding me in a space that was safe when I was doing things that were outside my comfort zone, but also cautioning me on, you know, I can be somewhat strong-willed.
Shocked. I know. Shocked.
Right? Me too.
Diana? Diana Cooper?
So sometimes I can sort of get my head stuck on something and and be like, well, that's just the direction I'm going. So bye, you know.
Yep.
But she had a really a great way of just sort of, we'd, you know, we'd go out to lunch. She was pescatarian, so she didn't eat any meat or dairy or anything. And she'd have like a fish taco sometimes, but we'd go out to lunch and I'd be telling her all of these things, especially in the beginning when I was first kind of forming this idea and really great at saying like, that sound, you know, that sounds like a good idea. Or what are you going to do? She always had the best questions too. What are you going to do with this? Or what are you going to do if this comes up? Or what are your ideas on? Just always making me think. And because I'd be like, oh, I'm just going to go do this thing. And she was like, well, I really want you to think this through.
I love that.
And make sure it's the right way to go.
I love that. I love that.
So she had a way of sort of cautioning me as well, but not taking my spirit away. And that's really what was the most beneficial to me, I think.
Well, I'm going to suggest to our listeners that if there are people out there who are, you know, maybe a little bit older and have had some interesting life experiences, you know, think about offering to mentor, you know, take a look around and see if there's somebody younger and more inexperienced that you could take under your wing. And frankly, you know, you're not too old to do that as well to somebody else coming
up. Oh, no.
Right?
And, as much as I called her my mentor, she called me her mentor.
Ah, I love
and
that.
And there's this mutually beneficial relationship. And think that if somebody is wanting to do that, that they if they come at it from a place of learning as well as teaching, I think it's beautiful.
Well, it's not only beautiful, but it's real. You know, because the reality is that we don't ever stop learning unless we say we do. You know, if we determine we've stopped learning, then yeah, but there's no reason to stop learning.
And you got to take the initiative as someone and look at people and say, you know what, I'm just going to ask them if they want to go have lunch or I think I have something that they may want.
Yeah. I love that. So once again, that green message that says 1 minute with an exclamation point, which means we're probably
I know, and now it's 30
seconds. Oh no,
Tom's all right really
so I know Tom's getting very pushy. So Diana, thanks again for you know, another great conversation. I love talking to you. You've got some great ideas and and I just love it. We have good conversations, so thank you. And thank you for listening. If you'd like to hear some of our earlier conversations, go to our website, kciw.org. Look under podcasts and our community. And while you're there, consider donating to our tower fund. We're moving our antenna, and you can donate to help us with that move. So that's kciw.org. Thanks. This is Candace Michelle for our community. See you next week.